listening to Women Who Change Tech, the podcast that gives you access to women who are contributing, inspiring, trailblazing, and disrupting the business of technology. We believe that when women inspire other women, amazing things happen. I'm your host, Allison Wade.
And I am your host, Jessie Sterenshoes, and we are connecting women around the world to share ideas that help us thrive and advance in our personal lives and in our careers.
Be sure to share this podcast with your friends, rate and subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, and help us bring Women Who Change Tech into the lives of more professionals.
Hold on to your seats as we give you a dose of inspiration from some of the most talented and creative women who are shifting the face of technology. Allison, what have you been up to?
Hey, good morning, Jessie. I'm happy to hear your voice again this morning. I have just gotten back from Las Vegas.
Ooh, are you allowed to tell me what you've been up to if you were there?
Yeah, no, I'm sorry. What happens in Vegas stays in Vegas. It's just the way it is.
It's going to be a really fun recording then. All right, moving on.
I'll tell you later.
Great. Well, then I'll tell you what I've been doing.
Go ahead.
Great. So I was in Budapest at Craft Conference. Actually, I did my talk on unlearning and also gave a full day workshop on unlearning the challenge of change. It's great. There's about close to 3,000 people at the conference there, and I'd never been to Budapest. And actually, while I was in line, in the speaker's line, I saw Portia, who's going to be our guest today. And we met up and hung out basically for the whole entire conference. It was really great getting to see her in person. I had met her online, like via Skype or something a couple years before. So to get to have time with her in person was fantastic. And then I also just got back from Maine, where we did our fifth ops conference with about 28 different people from all different tech companies from around the world. And that was fantastic as well.
Wow. I'm so excited that I'm going to meet Portia today. I've heard so much about her. She sounds so interesting in the whole concept of play and how this enhances our life. So I'm really excited to meet her. Mm-hmm. So, all right, I'll tell you what I was doing in Vegas. I was actually attending our Agile and DevOps conference in Las Vegas last week, and it went really, really well. It was a great conference. We had some amazing keynotes from Nathan Harvey, who talked about start your DevOps journey on the right foot. He's a DevOps expert and has been talking about this for years. He was kind of one of the guys on the leading edge of DevOps. And so he gave a great keynote along with many others. And it was a really great week. It's just a terrific conference. That's what I was doing in Vegas.
That sounds like a lot of fun. I wish I could have been there.
Yeah, it was really a great conference. There's a lot of things I love about Vegas, and there's a lot of things I hate about Vegas. And one thing I love about Vegas is that conference.
Nice.
I can't wait to meet Portia today. I'm really excited. Let's introduce Portia.
Hi, I want to introduce everybody to Portia Tung. She's a woman who shows us the power of play. And actually, Portia and I were just recently in Budapest together at Craft Conference, and we had an awesome time. We basically went to a couple sessions and then hung out like crazy, just playing games and meeting a bunch of really cool women. And I'm so excited for everybody to meet her. Portia is an executive and personal coach. She's an agile coach, a play researcher who's creating transformative change in a range of organizations, including the Prime Minister's Office, the NHS, British Airways, and global financial institutions. She readily draws from her 20 years of experience in the IT industry, ranging from an analyst programmer to a development manager and an IT consultant to an agile coach. She's also a trained professional coach. I'm so excited to introduce everybody to her. Thanks for being here, Portia.
Hey, Jessie and Allison.
Hey, Portia. I'm so excited to meet you. Jessie always meets her people in really exotic places like Budapest.
You know.
Well, you know, Budapest actually has a special place in my heart now because obviously Avengers Endgame only came out recently. And, you know, there is this kind of special mention of where Hawkeye met the Scarlett Johansson character in Budapest. So I knew there was going to be something special there. And lo and behold, it was Jessie. Who would have thought?
Ah,
Portia.
It was the 26th Avenger,
Jessica. Oh my goodness.
We locked eyes in the speaker line. That's actually what happened. So I was like, Portia? And then she's like, Jesse? And then we basically didn't shut up after that. I was like, come with me.
I can see that you two were probably a lot of trouble in Budapest.
You know it.
So, Portia, tell me how you first got into play. This is so interesting to me.
So there are kind of two starts. The first start was when I started working professionally after finishing my master's degree in computer science. And I quickly discovered that collaboration wasn't kind of the done thing in the workplace at the time I started working, which was 20 years ago. And so I needed to figure out some way of just continuously re-energizing myself and finding more like-minded people to play with and enjoy work and bring joy back to work, really, to keep me sane and keep my medical bills down. So I started submitting to conferences, inventing, if you like, imagining concepts like agile fairy tales and various games and sessions. And what happened was, because many of these conferences with their call for proposals were fairly meritocratic, is the only conclusion I can come to, I got the opportunity to design and run these sessions, and in the process meet more like-minded agilists who also believe that playing through change was possible. And that's really how I got into play professionally. The second, if you like, the second foray into play really was when I became a mum. And that was many years later, probably about 15 years later, having spent most of my career playing with adults in various guises, be it workshops or group sessions, conference keynotes, etc. I had my new baby girl, and very quickly she let me know that I hadn't played enough. not just in my adulthood, but actually in my childhood, because I then realized I didn't remember how to play really with children. And it made me realize that maybe my parents didn't play with me very much. And that was, I guess that was an enlightening moment for me, but also really quite distressing because I thought to myself, oh, that would explain a lot, wouldn't it? But at the same time, when I started to, I guess in the kind of classic Brené Brown style, articulate some of these fears in order to kind of move on and deal with them, I started talking to the adults around me and asking them about what their memories were of play in their childhood. And time again, and I would say finger in the air, about 90% of the adults, if not 95% that I spoke to, would tell me they didn't remember playing their children. And what was really interesting was when, if ever we got to play together as families or just mummies and children, they would turn around to me and go, you're pretty good at this, to which I'm really surprised. And I think that's really what got me into it, because at the end of the day, when you become a parent, they say you can only give what you have. And when, as soon as I realized that, I started learning the ukulele because I wanted to give a gift of music to my little girl. That's really how it all started.
Gosh, that's wonderful. I think that play is very underrated in the today's age as well. I think there was a time period, like you said, when I was growing up, where our parents really didn't play with us at all. Although I would say I had gangs of kids my own age to roam the streets with and play with, which I don't think children do today because of the safety issues. But I noticed with my own children who are 17 now, they were so busy with this soccer or busy with some sport or busy with some academic pursuit. And I think play sort of goes to the backdrop, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm. Same. Yeah. It's interesting when Portia, when you and I were together, you asked me that question, and nobody's ever asked me that question before. And it really got me thinking. And I guess I was in the smaller percentage. My mom is very playful. Mm-hmm. And so I guess up until you asked me that question, I think I always just took it for granted. Mm-hmm. Play is something that was very much a part of my childhood. My mom was always sitting on the floor and being very creative and imaginative with me. And so it is second nature to me. And I guess I can attribute that to her, but I never thought about it till you actually asked me that question. And I've started asking people, moms, that question. And like you said, a lot of people missed having that connection with their parents and wish they would have somebody to teach them how to be playful. So yeah, fascinating.
And it's really interesting as well, because if we look at the research behind this, they say that if an adult hasn't had enough play in their lives, and in particular between ages 0 to 5, and when they say play, we're talking about affectionate touch and hugs, physical contact like that, that their brains can be up to 30% smaller.
Wow.
Than what otherwise they could be. It kind of, that just sort of discovering that made me realize, wow, this is really about personal responsibility, not just for improving my own health, but actually the responsibility of having a child is much more than just outsourcing play to other children, mm-hmm. which I think is the default strategy for most adults. And it kind of made me think, well, I'm only going to have the one child. I've decided that I've done enough to hopefully contribute to humanity in that way. And when I look around and other adults have multiple children, very often the cited reasoning behind it is, well, then, you know, the second one can keep the first one company. And logically, mm-hmm. that makes a lot of sense, because obviously peer play, like what we're doing here, brings up something very different from, say, adult and child play. But there's something so magical between adult and child play, and then in particular, a loving adult, which may be a parent. I mean, that is where the magic really happens, because it allows children to play the way they want. Because I don't know if you remember, but even with like my best friend, we would bicker or argue eventually when we played, because so-and-so didn't play the way I wanted to play, because we all play differently. Whereas when you play as an adult, as a parent with your child, you know to take turns and you know what fair is, and they sure know what fair is when it comes to play. And you strike the deal of, for the next 10 minutes, you're going to play, we're going to play your way, and then we're going to switch. And they love that. And knowing that they can trust you to stick to those rules is just absolutely magical. An example of this is this weekend I made an extra effort to play more with my little girl. And just on Saturday and Sunday, probably if you were to time it as you would, maybe 30 minutes or an hour. And I felt exhausted. I needed like a nap by Sunday afternoon. But she turned around to me at bedtime and said, "Mummy, that felt like we'd spent the whole half term together," which is a week usually. Mm-hmm. And that was only 2 days this weekend. And I think that's kind of the quality of play we're talking about as well.
That's so, so remarkable. And it's just, yeah, it's so amazing. So when you infuse this into work setting, how do you deal with adults who find it so foreign?
The great thing really is there are many parallels between play and various analogies in real life. Mm-hmm. So the obvious one will be Marmite, this kind of paste that we have in Britain. Either people love Marmite or they hate it. You know, it's very polarized reaction, possibly like politicians. But anyway, we're going to move away from that topic. But on the subject of Marmite, what's really interesting is people either hate it or love it. And that's also what I found through my play research, right? So people would either be like enthralled, and before they even knew my surname, they'd ask me, "Okay, when's your next session? I want to come to it." Those would be the people who loved play. And then there'd be people who go, "All right, I'm going to stop talking to you because there's absolutely nothing wrong with my life. I feel perfectly fine. Please go away now." And so those are the people who would have an allergic effect to play. And that is actually the same reaction I get as an executive agile coach and agile coach working in organizations when we go through change, actually. So when I started getting the same response, I thought, well, this is interesting. And it's also the same response with taboos, of course, as you recognize. So this pattern. And actually what I've noticed is with play, there are some really kind of, if you like, strict rules about play, again, which people think are paradoxical, but play is a very, very meaningful, worthwhile, and can be a very structured thing. So for example, true play is safe play, fair play, and being a good sport. So one of the problems we have, for example, with agile transformations, now whether or not you agree to call it transformation, etc., we'll leave that aside, right? But if we want organizations to change, and then all we do is tell people, JFDI, just flipping do it, just change thyself, and I, as the person in charge, will not be changing, that's not going to work. But likewise, that happens throughout the rest of the organization. So it's not just a hierarchical thing. So just as if we force people to play, that's punishment, not play. Forcing people to change is also more like coercion, right? Rather than an open invitation for people to develop themselves. So it's no wonder we get so much resistance when we do change the old school way.
Mm-hmm. Do you find that you get people who are like vehemently don't want to do this and are really bad at it because it hasn't sort of, they don't have a natural inkling. But once they get a hold of this concept, do they, are there people that have just become sort of like, I love this and it's sort of life changing?
So yeah, absolutely. I think the thing is, I don't go in there and go, right, we're going to spend 30 minutes in recess and play. I mean, I think that would freak out most people. But the key thing to remember about play is when you get into play, you get into a state of flow. So Mihaly did loads and loads of research on flow, and he actually started off researching into happiness, then play, then flow. Yeah. So it's really important to see that evolution of his research. So with play, when you get into play, you're non-judgmental because you are preoccupied with what you're doing and you're trying to have the most fun, be at your best, live in the present moment. And that's the thing. So in a playful setting, shall we say, people aren't judged for who they are and what they do, but rather that we trust that everyone's doing themselves, you know, doing the best themselves, and that they will also help others become the best version of themselves. Mm. Yeah. So it's a really open invitation, non-judgmental. And what people struggle with, I have to say, Alison, is judging themselves.
Mm. Yeah. Imagine actually. Mm. So can you give us an example of something that you would do in a setting to encourage people to play sort of in the workplace, so our listeners can sort of understand what play means in that sense?
Yeah. So it's really straightforward and it's very close to what probably Jesse does as well. So kick off a meeting with an icebreaker or a warm-up exercise, really quick one. And it's a very formal meeting. You can just say, well, let's just take 5 minutes to warm up because research proves that this will accelerate the efficiency of this meeting and also ignite creativity. And then to which point most people go, yes, we're in, just stop talking, let's play. And that icebreaker could range from something like, I quite like top trumps. I do like using tools, which is these. Do you have top trumps in America?
No, I don't.
I have to bring you a set.
We have a trump, but I don't know what you're talking about.
Indeed, whether or not you want multiple. Right, but let's leave it there. Okay.
Yeah. Okay. Just leave them there.
But yeah, so in Britain, we have these card games called top trumps. Mm-hmm. And essentially they could be top trumps for the Avengers. So you have the different Avenger characters, for example, and each character will have the same set of attributes like, I don't know, courage, power, intelligence, and all of them will have the same attributes, but with various different numbers based on their perceived ability around these attributes. So a really fun thing to do, for example, is just to randomly deal out some of these cards, like 5 or 6, and then people kind of just compare the top trump cards, have a giggle, and it just kind of really loosens, I guess, the heartstrings and get people connecting with each other. Once again, I recently did this as a conference call. It was a blind conference call, so no video. And I did it without tools. And I said, okay, if you were a superhero, who would you be and why? Mm. And it went quiet for a moment and then things really got going. And then the most senior member in the call just blurted out, I would be Wonder Woman. And at this point, everyone just burst into laughter. I'm sure we could even hear the ones on mute. Do you know what I mean? It was that loud from the other side of the ocean. And you could see, you could hear from his voice, he was just thinking it. He hadn't meant to say it. So at this point, I'm going to obviously change his name to protect the innocent. I said, Jacob. I said, why would you be Wonder Woman then? In a very, you know, respectful voice, because that's how we play. And he said, well, I just think she's got a great lasso and, you know, she's all for justice and getting things right. And of course, you know, we all laugh some more. And then, you know, that's the oil in the machine, if you like. And that got everyone else going. And, you know, it was an hour call. But even though we played for 15 minutes, we finished 20 minutes early and got everything we needed done.
Wow.
Love it. Love it. That's great.
So that was a remote call, though, you said. It wasn't
Absolutely.
Yeah, see, that's awesome that you can do this because there's so many remote teams. And to be able to do that remotely is just so much fun.
Yeah. And I believe there's also some curious research which was kind of thrown my way. And they asserted that it's people, a human being, can trust somebody or know whether or not to trust somebody quicker just by voice alone.
Interesting.
So, you know, all this talk about, oh, well, in person or video is really important so I can see the whites of their eyes, blah, blah, blah. When I kind of saw this piece of research assertion thrown my way, I thought, well, that is interesting. Because actually, when I look back, I've done quite a lot of remote work as well. And some of the most meaningful relationships I've had with colleagues is when I haven't been able to use video with them for whatever reasons. And we were never going to meet in person. But I needed them to know that I was there to help them, even though I needed a favor from them right now. And it was just, it really makes you think about connection, not just rapport and not all that kind of mirroring and pacing and all that NLP stuff. It's much more than that. It's really about people connecting, wanting to achieve something together.
That's so interesting. I wanted you to tell us more about your school of play and where the idea came from and more about that. Could you tell us?
Yeah, sure. You know, I'm probably a very quiet, maybe possibly timid person. And so when people see me on stage talking about play, they have all these assumptions about why I got into play and therefore I must be a very extroverted thinker and all these things. But I started the School of Play when I looked around and I thought, if I am to somehow make a contribution that can change the workplace in my working lifetime, in time for my little girl to benefit, I better start now. So that's really when I thought, okay, I've got to take myself seriously. And I still remember the moment my first checkbooks, I mean, that's 3 years ago now. I mean, in Britain, we still have checkbooks. But anyway, I remember when my checkbooks arrived and, you know, printed on them was the School of Play. And I was like, now this is real. I can write a check with the School of Play on it. what kind of world, you know, lets that happen? And I'm like, okay, there is room for play. And really, the vision behind it is, and it just came to me all of a sudden as they do visions. And I remember thinking to myself, one day, in the future, just as my little girl, and she'll be grown up by then, sort of Starship Enterprise or Star Trek style, you know, getting on board her starship, she turns around to me, and by this point, I'm probably a head in a jar somewhere. And she says to me, Mummy, I've never understood why you used to go on about this kind of self-realization and all this important stuff, Maslow's hierarchy, all this stuff. You used to go on and on about it growing up, and how important it is to enjoy your work. And she said, I don't understand it because I work with my friends. I hang out with them. I tour the galaxy, establishing intergalactic peace and making friends with all different kinds of species. And that's what I do. And I love doing what I do. So, yeah, well, anyway. And, you know, thanks, Mom, anyway, for all that, whatever it is you did. And I'll turn around to her and I'll think to myself, my job is done.
Yes.
And then she'll turn around. And then before she goes, she'll turn around, she'll say to me, she'll say, are you coming then? And then no doubt being a jar, being in a jar as a brain or a head, I'll be attached to some kind of robot. And then I'll kind of follow her on board because I would like to think I would be the onboard empath.
You know? Oh,
but there you go.
Lovely. I shall ever think of you as a head in a jar, Portia.
What kind of jar would it be?
Indeed.
So with your School of Play, what kind of projects do you have going on? Like, do you have some classes coming up or play projects that are coming out of
that you're doing? So because I'm an independent play researcher, I'm looking into applying for a grant to do some formal research on play, but also the latest concept I've been exploring is something called playful leadership. So using the latest findings in neuroscience and psychology and coaching and various fields of study, I've harnessed them and distilled them into the most effective, efficient, and fun way of creating change for the individual as well as organizations. So in playful leadership, we look at a bunch of attributes that playful leaders have. And what's really interesting as well is I think now I look back, I've always believed that everyone is a leader. You don't have to have a special badge that says manager to say Bob is manager. We're all leaders of our own lives. And it's really interesting because now I'm 44 this year. Now when I look back as well again into history, I think about how actually women were leading all their lives right up to the moment they got their vote. They were running households, and many of us continue to do so. And of course, dads and men do as well. But I think leadership, the way we still look at leadership, be it in MBAs and other establishments, is now outdated, as also young people will tell us, right? So being able to lead your own life in a meaningful way is increasingly important and valued. And I think that's kind of where I wanted to go with this idea of playful leadership. And, you know, Jesse, you mentioned about that, you know, play is a skill you can learn. So there's this, in Dr. Stuart Brown's book on play, there's this great story he tells about the Americans doing some research on play and mice. So, of course, it's always the rats and mice. I think it's rats in this case. And there were two groups of rats, these scientists. They took two groups of rats, and the first group of rats were allowed to play. And the second group of rats weren't allowed to play. And now you're going to say to me, well, Portia, how did they know?
Yes.
So, you know, I'm very serious about my play research. So I kind of dabbled in looking at what they meant. So it turns out that if you pick up a rat, and I imagine any rodent really, with their permission, obviously kindly, if you pick up a rat and you tickle it under its chin, its whiskers will start quivering and it will start emitting this kind of sharp squeaking noise of pleasure. And that's how the scientists say they knew the rats had played. So presumably when those rats were kept, they were in a fairly well-stimulated environment with toys and buddies and stuff, whereas the others who were not allowed to play were probably more solitary, possibly confined, and had little to no stimuli to get their brains going. So in this experiment, they took two groups of the rats and they took them to a room. So what they did was they released the second group, which is the group who hadn't played, and then they popped them into the room, and then they released a cat into the room. Yeah, I mean, you think these scientists, I don't know, pretty edgy. Anyway, it turns out they did give the rats an out, which was a mouse hole, which is great. So the question here is, when they repeated this exercise with both groups of rats, those who played and those who didn't play, what do you think happened when the cat was released into the room? So what do you think happened with the group that played and the cat was released into the room? What did they do?
I would speculate that they had more creative tactics of getting away from the cat, and they didn't probably panic and squeal. Would that be accurate?
Well, so that
did the other ones get eaten?
Wow, you guys are pretty gory. So with the first group that played, quite rightly, as Austin said, because it's an instinct for survival, it's an instinct, right? They just scuttled into the hole for safety. And in fact, both groups did that. It's a survival instinct, okay? So they both squirreled in, as you'd expect. However, what was really interesting was when the cat was removed from the room, what do you think then happened with the group that played? What happened then?
They probably came out, did they, to sort of explore?
I think they celebrated.
They had a little mouse party.
Excellent. They did. Little hats and everything. Yes, they did. They did indeed come out again and, you know, sniffed around first to make sure danger was gone and they could come back out. Now, what do you think happened to the group who'd never played and had, you know, obviously scuttled?
I think they played dead, probably.
So it turned out that the mice who went into the hole and had never played, after the cat, the threat was removed, the mice, the rats, never left the hole again. They never left the hole again.
Right.
And that was where they stayed.
Interesting. So their fear factor was way higher than the mice that had played.
Yeah, indeed, absolutely. And to the extent that it wasn't calibrated enough for their positive survival as opposed to their demise. I think that's what I really tried to do with playful leadership, is to make it into a repeatable learning process so that the mice who, so that mice, rats or humans who find ourselves in our holes and think and are still in our holes and think we're stuck, I wanted to make play a skill that can get us out of that hole.
Right. That's so interesting because you do see when, especially when Agile is being implemented in some companies, the fear factor gets really high, doesn't it, amongst some of people who...
There's paralysis.
Yes, who are very comfortable with the way things are and don't want to change and don't want to do anything different. Their fear factor just goes way, way up.
Yes, absolutely. And I think it's up to the people involved in that change or who are orchestrating it, to provide a loving environment where it's nurturing and where people don't feel terrified or, you know, shamed into changing, because that's not the way, that's not the way we would grow our own families and our own children. So why would we do that to our colleagues, right? But it does happen. People end up going on effectively a hunt on who's the least agile, and let's post their name up over the photocopier so everyone can know. I mean, it's never quite as explicit as that, unfortunately, because if it were, then I could take down the poster and find out who created the poster and how speak to them in a hopefully a loving and caring way and see what it is that's stopping them from embracing change for themselves, right, as opposed to the group. And I think that's...
Yeah, absolutely.
It's got to be inclusive.
Definitely.
I love it, going on a hunt for who's the least agile.
I was just at our Agile DevOps conference in Vegas last week, and one of the keynote speakers, Nathan Harvey from Google, actually set that up as an exercise for the room. He made some prior arrangements with the audiovisual guy, and he basically made it so that the AV guys, you know, that the AV didn't work. He actually had a blank slide up, but he was like, I don't know what happened. And the AV guy got on the microphone and said, I don't know, it was working on my machine before this. And then, and then they had this whole exchange back and forth. And the point of it was, he was like, well, we need to figure out who to blame for this. Like, and he just sort of went down this path, and the room was sitting there getting so uncomfortable. But then he, of course, kind of met, everybody knew it was a setup eventually. But the idea was, is who, and he talked about that whole concept of who do we blame when something goes wrong, and how we feel attached to finding someone to blame all the time.
And I wonder how much of that is instinct as opposed to learned behavior. And even having this, my six-year-old as well, and just watching her grow and change over time, I wonder how much of that kind of blaming behavior is learned from other adults around her, including myself, for example, right? And I could hear other adults going, oh, well, that's shame she's feeling. That's why she's looking down at her shoes. I was like, no, that's because there's a some bird poop on her shoe. That's why she's looking down there. If you look at cognitive abilities of children, and let's not underestimate them, because that's another thing we do.
Yeah,
it's fascinating. And I said to my little girl, actually, over the weekend, because I like to do these little child-friendly tests. And I said to her, you know, Emma, what stops us from changing? And she looks at me like slightly oddly, and she goes, nothing, mummy. I thought, wow, interesting, nothing. And I said, well, in that case, so what helps us change? And she said, oh, be myself. And if we look at the years and years of psychology research, that's what it's talking about, right? We're all working towards, each and every one of us, is that we're working towards becoming whichever version of ourselves that we long to be most. And that was probably the version we were born as, right? And I think that's what we forget. And if we can just listen to each other more for longer than 7 minutes a day, hopefully, and start addressing some of these imbalances and actually just show each other a little bit more humanity, then I think this notion of change is hard, it's full of suffering. I don't think it's nonsense, because obviously that would be disrespectful to discount people's experiences. But I just don't think it needs to be that way. I think when change is done well, you never hear a child complaining that they really suffered to learn how to ride their bike, right? Because for them,
that's very true.
It's just they want to cycle like everybody else, and they're a bit gutted they can't do it. But then they don't call it shame unless the adults make them feel ashamed.
That's the old Maria Montessori. I actually have a degree in early childhood education, funnily enough. And I don't work in early childhood education, but that's the old Maria Montessori method, is she believes that you shouldn't differentiate between play and work. And that's sort of where we get into trouble. And if you go to a Montessori school, everything's sort of leveled the same, whether you're putting away the toy, you're playing with the toy, or you're getting the toy out, it's all the same exercise for them. It's not about one's a job and one's a chore and the other's the joy part. And I think that's probably how we separate ourselves in our lives from the joyful tasks, the things we don't like to do, and labeling work as work and so on.
Yeah. And I think if you trace it back to kind of, you know, history of our civilization, it comes with industrialization, right? When we start thinking, how do we get more efficient? We don't think about effective. If the purpose of our lives is to enable each of us to be best versions of ourselves, that would be looking at effectiveness, not efficiency, because we all grow at a different rate anyway, right? But instead we treat people like battery hen chickens and we expect them to birth X number of eggs and grow in this way. And why aren't they this quality? And that's all judgment. Mm. It doesn't come from love. It comes from judgment. It comes from measurement. And again, it just comes back to coercion and saying you're underperforming. Oh my goodness. Mm-hmm. Can you imagine telling a child that you're underperforming? How devastating is that?
Mm. It's an adult. I've actually birthed 6 eggs since we started.
Thanks for letting us know, Jesse. That's very efficient of you.
I'm very efficient.
I wish you to know that we were expecting
my schooling. Get an A, a great A.
Yes, exactly. That's how we define ourselves as enough. You know, we are enough already.
So interested to ask one more question, and that is, do you think that there is some sort of nature versus nurture involved in people's ability to play or people's personalities? I have twins, and so I see a side-by-side comparison. Although they are opposite sex, I have a boy and a girl, but I would say their personalities are very different in terms of how they take feedback. And I have one child who's particularly defensive. Now, they grew up in the same household, so I sort of attribute that to more nature than I do nurture. So it's harder for me to get that child to relax. If you say something, it's automatically perceived as a criticism, where, you know, that sort of thing. Do you find that sort of out in the workplace as well?
Yeah, I think it comes down to assumptions. Because even with the word personality, we're naturally assuming that is innate. But it kind of depends on which school of thinking or psychology and all of those things we're looking at. Because if you come from a school of psychology looking at personality as the culmination of habit, then all of a sudden we can change habits if you believe in the growth mindset, which research supports, then actually personality isn't a fixed thing. It's growing such as our toenails or our hair is, then that can equally change. And I think the other thing, which I'm really struck by, is how different each and every person is, regardless of their age. And I think they will have their own physiological challenges, which is their environment, but as well as their own bodies, which may mean that if for whatever reasons, for one child, every time they break something, something else is wired in the brain to send a signal to cause them pain, but that's not visible to everybody else. That might trigger a different response, right? To somebody else who doesn't have that invisible physiological reaction. So yeah, I think it's about treating everyone as an individual is what I do in the workplace. So when we talk about things like scaling agile and come and do the certificate and pay for my retirement, I'm like, well, that's great for you.
Pay for my retirement.
And I'd like to think, well, how is that helping each of these individuals change? Because, you know, changes happen en masse, right? We all have different development, as I mentioned. And everyone is different in some way. And I think that's the beauty of humanity. Otherwise, we wouldn't have got as far as we have now. Yeah, so recognizing people are different. And the other thing I'd say is about sort of learning styles and learning preferences. So some people would like to receive feedback in the form of compliments, whereas others would just like it cold, you know, like gruel or porridge. Yes. And then they would be offended if you sugarcoated it. And you're like, oh, okay. So I think it's as much about each of us learning those styles of communication, but not pandering, not pandering either, right? Because, you know, if something is bad, it's neither good nor bad. It's just what it is. I'm sorry, darling, but the hedgehog has died.
Right.
You know, it's a fact of life. I couldn't save it. I didn't have the skills to resuscitate it, bury it. And I think that's all we can do, right?
Right.
Good that you have an imaginary dog, though, so you could bring
it
back.
Yes, indeed. And I can revive it.
Isn't that old joke about the don't just tell me my cat died while I was on vacation? And you could have said, well, your cat is on the roof and I can't get it down.
Oh my God.
And I think there's a thing. Exactly. You know, most of the time it's because we ourselves are incongruent with ourselves and our feelings and our own reactions to things that we then cover it up. In the end, what the child or what the other adults receive is a bastardized version of what's really happened. Right. And it confuses the heck out of everybody. And they'll never know. They do one agile transformation and they're like burnt and they'll never want to do it again. And I think that's why it's so important to, you know, give it your best shot. And who you get into your organization to do that, I think one of the best criteria to find out if you would get someone in to work as an agile coach in your organization is, would you let them look after your children?
Oh, gosh.
Yeah. Would you let them play with your children? Because if they cannot play with your children, I would really challenge how effective they are in transformation, because children are the taskmasters of play and uncertainty and options exactly. and improv and creativity.
And they'll tell you if they don't like it.
Yeah.
Exactly. Instant feedback.
Yeah, exactly. So do you want to play a game?
Always.
Yes.
Yay. Perfect. Do you want to play a game that we do? I think, Portia, we tried it mm-hmm. a little bit, where you do the beginning sound for a word, and then the other person does the ending of the word, and then you say the mm-hmm. word together, the word that you created together. Do you remember that one?
Yeah, it reminds me of Sesame Street.
Yeah, the Sesame Street game, exactly. Mm-hmm. So if I said, let's see, plea, and then you said the end.
Ding.
Okay, and then we would say pleading. Yeah. And then Allison, so you would do, I'll do a beginning of a word. Allison, you do the ending, okay?
Okay.
Nah.
Nah. Damn, Jesse, you're stumping me. Nah. Nagging. Ing.
Nagging?
Nagging, yes.
Perfect. God,
that took me a long while.
Okay, now Portia, you start one and I'll finish it.
Bake.
Ing.
Baking.
Now, Allison, you start one.
Con.
Fusing.
Con.
Fusing. Okay, Allison, give one to Portia.
S.
Essential.
Together?
Essential.
Yes, perfect. Okay, Portia, you give one to Allison.
Rain.
Burst.
Together?
Rain.
Rain burst.
Nice.
I tried not to go with an ing.
Yay!
Perfect. All right, I'm going to give one to you, Allison. Side.
Eye.
Side eye.
Perfect. Does anybody want
to? I think that's the fun thing with this, right? Because it illustrates the assumptions we had when we started playing this game, that it needed to be A, real words, and B, it needed to make sense. But actually, we never said there were any rules like that, you know? And that's the power of play, to elicit all these ways of thinking that we maybe didn't even know we had.
Exactly. I liked the nah bubba.
That was so hard for me. I don't know. I mean, I still can't think of anything other than nagging. What else? What ends with a...
Who knows? I don't know, but I liked our gibberish. I don't think we should change anything about it, because that was my favorite one of the whole
game. Yeah, blah, 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 blah.
I'm
going to try to use that in a sentence soon.
on a conference call, I hate it.
On a conference call, for sure, as a kickoff. Or make that the title of an email and see if you get a good response.
Well, I love it.
Yeah, that game's great, because like you said, it's about things. You may begin something, but it may end very differently than what you thought. Mm-hmm. And play is like that, right? It goes in different directions, and you have to be open to letting things just take you where they're going to take you, and being open to being flexible and letting the rules bend mm-hmm. and flex, and like being okay with it being silly and playful and fun. And that's all right, as long as everybody in the group has trust in each other and that feeling of safety, then it really doesn't matter.
And our brains look forward to it. You know, they like the prediction errors. Yeah. They like the surprises.
Yeah, actually they do. I agree. They really, first of all, it's like this panicked feeling when I couldn't think of anything to go with nah. But then afterwards it's like, oh, this is really fun.
Exactly.
That's the best part. The other thing I find is if, for example, it was my go and I couldn't come up something, it's also likely that nobody else could, you know, and it's just enjoying in the not knowing together, but that we'll figure it out, you know?
Yeah. It's, I mean, that's human beings. Like, that's where we are. We don't always have to have the right answer or any answer. And that's okay when you're playing. Mm. It's okay.
Yeah. It's so true. I actually get that feeling sometimes from when you are a leader and you sort of say, I don't actually know what we should do right now. Mm-hmm. Sometimes that makes people very uncomfortable. They sort of mm-hmm. want to be told what to be done, you know? Mm-hmm. So it mm-hmm. is an exercise in allowing all of the ideas to bubble to the top and to know that everybody, you know, has that individual power. Like you said, Portia, that, you know, treating people like an individual and that they could individually contribute.
And it's such a courageous thing, I find, to find somebody who will acknowledge that they don't know. Mm. That they're confident that we'll figure it out together. I think that's one of the most congruent responses you can have. I think this kind of macho idea, be it women or men leaders, of I have all the answers. I mean, again, that goes back to old school parenting of the divine or whatever. And I just don't think it's possible for us to have all the answers all of the time. If we did, then society wouldn't be where it is now, right?
Exactly. Exactly. Mm. So tell us what you have coming up next for you.
Yeah, so really excited. This year I've launched a couple of new courses. So the first one is called Effective Enterprise Agile Transformation. And that takes place next week. So in June in London. Great. And then again in October, November this year. And also I'm doing it in Sweden. I'm very excited about the Effective Enterprise Agile Transformation, because it's actually based on the Agile Adventure novel I published 6 years ago. And that was based on the idea of a choose your own adventure. I don't know if you're familiar with those. Or your listeners are.
Yes.
Yeah. And I remember just falling in love with the choose your own adventure books, where you, the protagonist, as well as the reader, get to decide on the outcome of the story. And I think that was just such an empowering, engaging approach to change. And that's how I've always kind of seen my journeys into agile transformations, and you know, turning them into an adventure allows us to really shape our destiny, if you like. So that's one of the courses. Great. And then the other one that's coming up in July and October again as well is called Playful Leadership. It's the foundation course where we'll look at things like the play cycle, how people play, so that when you recognize the cycle and different learning styles, what that means to you, but also how you can enable others to play more when you do change, so that it's enjoyable.
Great. And you're also doing a keynote, right?
Yes. I look forward to playing with you both at Agile 2019, where I'll be doing the closing keynote on playful leadership in August. I'm really excited about that because that's the first time I'm keynoting on playful leadership. And for me, it's just been such an honor as a way to provide, I guess, service to the world of looking at how play can help us be better versions of ourselves and help each other do that and create a better world. I know those sound kind of bold aspirations, but why else would we go to work, right?
Absolutely. Yeah.
I'm so happy for you for that. I cannot wait.
Excellent. I'm looking forward to seeing you then.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, thank you so much for being on our podcast today. This was super playful and fun.
Absolutely.
It was so lovely to meet you, Portia.
Yes, Alison. I hope to meet you in person soon.
Yes, absolutely.
Thanks again.
Well, thanks for playing. Enjoy your rain bursts. I've got mine today in the UK.
Bye.
Well, I really enjoyed having Portia Tung as our guest today, didn't you?
Yes, she was amazing. I learned so much about play and how play helps the workplace and helps humans in general. It was awesome.
I thought there were so many interesting points that she made. One of the things that stuck out to me was when she talked about how if play wasn't something that was part of our childhood, that our brains are actually 30% smaller. So interesting.
That was extraordinary to know that there's actual research that proves that a lack of play and lack of that kind of interaction can actually stifle human development.
I know. It's kind of hard to believe. I think there's so much pushback around how important play is in our daily lives, not only as children, but as adults. And in the way we're innovative and creative. And then here's the science to back that up.
Incredible.
Mm-hmm. I really also enjoyed the things that she talked about when it came to being effective versus being efficient, right? So how we look at the working world in our schools and how they're kind of set up for the industrial age, and that we don't go around asking children how to be so effective or efficient. And she talked about how hens could lay this many eggs in a certain amount of time. And it's kind of how we treat our students as well. So I thought that was interesting. And in that, that's really not the way that we should set up the working world.
Yeah, it's kind of like that view of quantitative work rather than quality. Mm-hmm. That we're always trying to produce more and more at a rapid pace, but not sometimes interested in the quality and how much progress are we really making.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So what was one of your favorite points that she made?
Well, I really love the definition of playful leadership. She's done a lot of formal research and a study around this and how this changes individuals and how she's working to bring playful leadership into the workplace and how this is something that can be learned, that these attributes, I mean, I think people think of leaders as natural attributes, but she says you can actually teach this and how treating people like individuals and using play as a tool can help them bring out their leadership styles and help bring out the best in others. That's the part that I really loved.
Well, let's take a listen.
The latest concept I've been exploring is something called playful leadership. So using the latest findings in neuroscience and psychology and coaching and various fields of study, I've harnessed them and distilled them into the most effective, efficient, and fun way of creating change for the individual as well as organizations. So in playful leadership, we look at a bunch of attributes that playful leaders have. And what's really interesting as well is I've always believed that everyone is a leader. You don't have to have a special badge that says manager to say Bob is a manager. We're all leaders of our own lives. And it's really interesting because now I'm 44 this year. Now when I look back as well again into history, I think about how actually women were leading all their lives right up to the moment they got their vote. They were running households and many of us continue to do so. And of course, dads and men do as well. But I think leadership, the way we still look at leadership, be it in MBAs and other establishments, is now outdated, as also young people will tell us, right? So being able to lead your own life in a meaningful way is increasingly important and valued. And I think that's kind of where I wanted to go with this idea of playful leadership.
You've been listening to Women Who Change Tech, the podcast that connects you to extraordinary women for deep, inspiring conversations.